Okay. First thing I want to say is the midterms have all been graded by the reader. And then what she does is she gives number grades, and then I kind of go through the pile and I try and figure out how the number grades should correspond to letter grades. So the midterms will be available for you next week. Monday's a holiday, isn't it?
Yes.
So it'll be on Wednesday next week, our next class. Any of you have any questions? Okay. Today I'm going to be talking about the 1948-49 period, which is the climax of the whole story of the early Cold War. All these events having to do with the Berlin blockade and the establishment of NATO and the establishment of a German state by the spring of 1949. This, in a sense, is the end of the first phase of the story of the Cold War, early Cold War. Why is that story of interest? Well, because of the light it throws on the fundamental question we're concerned with in this class, this whole problem of what makes for war. There's this view kind of built into a lot of the international relations literature that if you want to understand war, you should focus on crises, right? It's as though the system, the international system, it just kind of throws out these crises at random. They're kind of discrete events. You know, wars are preceded by a crisis. You want to understand wars, you focus on a crisis, right? And if you treat them as discrete events, statistically independent events, you'd apply all your fancy statistical methods, regression analysis, and so on, you come up with these conclusions. You know, it's very common in the political science literature and international relations to take that sort of approach. Right? And that particular view, which focuses on crises, which treats crises as of fundamental importance. This is associated with major approaches to policy, right, both on the right and on the left. You know, on the right, there's huge emphasis in American policy during the Cold War on deterrence. Deterrence is the be-all and end-all of strategy. And what does deterrence mean? It means affecting the calculations of the would-be aggressor at his moment of truth, at the peak of a crisis. Right? You know? The policy implication of that emphasis on deterrence is that you want your deterrent threats to be as credible as possible. You want to do whatever you have to do to make it clear to your adversary that you're not going to back down. Burn your bridges, so on. Right? Great emphasis in American strategic thought during the Cold War, both at the academic level and the level of policy, on deterrence. Right? And that's a view which emphasizes the importance of crises in the story. But it's not just the right that takes that view, the left also takes a view which emphasizes the importance of crises. What is the left? The left thinks that, there's a real chance that people could just stumble into war, that wars break out by accident, that the risk of inadvertent war is really great. Right? And so if you want peace, what you have to focus on is what they call crisis stability, making sure that in the event of a crisis, things don't just kind of get out of hand. This is why the whole argument that was made about July 1914 was so important in the literature on nuclear weapons and foreign policy. There's this notion of what you want is to make sure that these forces welling up from within the military sphere don't get out of hand and sweep people into a war that has no real political justification. This notion was very important because, in the nuclear age, it's obvious no one wants a nuclear war. Certainly the United States didn't want one. Soviet Union didn't want one. And nevertheless, there's this fear that it could happen. So how do you square that circle? How could something like that happen if no one wants it? Well, it could happen by accident. Happened once before, July 1914. You know, that whole approach focuses on the importance of making sure that these military dynamics do not, cause escalation to a war that no one wants, cause an accidental war. This accidental war problem is considered very important. Strategic stability, very important. And it was the conceptual basis of arms control. Why do you want arms control? You know, why is arms control considered so important? It's like, well, because through arms control, we could structure the military system so that neither side has an incentive to go first. If we make sure that both sides, have kind of secure nuclear forces that can only be used for retaliation and not for a first strike, then we will have a stable military environment. That should be the focus of our efforts, right? But the emphasis placed on arms control by people on the left was rooted in that theory that what happens in a crisis, that's what's really important. That's what you got to focus on. So, all right. My point to you, and this is one of the main points that I want to kind of flesh out in the class today, is that that is not the way, the only way, certainly, that these issues should be approached. And that there's a third approach to war that does not emphasize crisis to anything like that extent. That denies the crises of any importance. But it views an armed conflict as the climax of a political process unfolding over time with its own logic, right? Where one thing leads to another in not a random way. Historical understanding is not simply, streaming together a whole bunch of discrete events over time, but rather understanding the logic that leads from one thing to another, right? And this is an approach which has important policy implications because it suggests that instead of trying simply to deter the aggressor when a crisis reaches its climax, what we want to do in terms of policy is to be able to have some influence over the way the political process that unfolds over a period of years, sometimes over decades, that could lead to an armed conflict, runs its course by shaping the incentives and disincentives within which the adversary has to work. And we want the adversary to do that same sort of thing with us. Right? It's a very different approach to policy because it doesn't emphasize the military side the way people both on the right and on the left do. The whole deterrence philosophy emphasizes the importance of military threats. We should be able to scare the living daylights out of them by having the sort of military force which would create a sense on their part that we might actually pull the trigger. And on the left, all this stuff about strategic stability and having military forces where there's no incentive to preempt. This is also a military view of what policy should be. My argument to you is a big mistake. It's not an original argument. It goes back to Clausewitz. They say politics is of fundamental importance. Military stuff is secondary importance, right? What you want to be able to influence is that political process that could lead to a war, could lead to a stable system. Okay, so these issues are important because of the policy implications. Okay, so then the question is, if your goal is to understand that logic, how do you go about doing that? If your goal is to understand how international politics works, why it is that one thing leads to another, how do you do that? Answer, studying the history. Studying the history in what way? In this kind of mindless way that people do? And just plunging into the documents and then just hoping that some deep conceptual understanding is going to automatically emerge. This whole notion, the facts will speak for themselves. Well, the facts never speak for themselves. You have to make them speak by bringing a certain political, a certain theoretical perspective to bear. That's why international relations theory is of such fundamental importance in this context. Again, it doesn't give you the answers. That's not why it's important, but it helps you bring the questions into focus in a way that they're empirically manageable. That you have these kind of clear questions in your mind that you can then take to the historical sources and use those questions to draw meaning from the sources. You see what's relevant. The test of relevance is whether it will help you answer the questions that you're bringing to bear. Okay? And in this case, the case of the story of the early Cold War, 1945 to 1949, right? That's what we've been doing. We've been bringing a theoretical perspective to bear in order to get some sense for what the logic is underlying the course of events in this period. It's not simply, oh, the Soviets lay on the Iran crisis in 46. They lay on the Berlin blockade crisis in 48 just as an act of pure aggressiveness. No, that's not what's going on here at all. So how is the theory brought to bear? Well, it's like, if you're a realist, you look at this stuff from the standpoint of the Soviet Union and the United States at the end of the war, how do things look? Europe is divided. You might not like it. It might not be your optimal solution, but it's a hell of a lot better than a Third World War. We can live with a divided Europe, you know, the Americans think. You know, as long as we keep the Soviets from taking over all of Europe, you know, we'll you know, hold on to our half of Europe, but we're not going to go to war to force them out of Eastern Europe. And they make the same calculation about us, right? We might ideally like to have communist regimes all over Europe, maybe all over the world, but not if it means another world war, not with the strongest country in the world. Those power considerations are absolutely fundamental, even for countries as ideological as the United States and the Soviet Union. Right? The power considerations discipline the objectives. They force objectives into line with political realities, with power realities. That perspective suggested that there's a real problem here. Cold War, you know, is puzzling. It's not like people say, oh, well, look at how different they are ideologically. Obviously, there's going to be this problem. No. Because the power factor should come into play. Why wasn't there automatic peace? Why didn't Soviet power and American power balance each other so totally in Europe that neither of them had much room for maneuver to change the status quo in fundamental ways, and certainly no third power, you know, had any room for maneuver? Why was there not, you know, peace right from the start? You know, it's like there's a basic rule about how the two sides could get along. You know, they call the shots on their side of the line of demarcation. We call the shots on our side of the line of demarcation. End of story. We get along with each other on that basis, right? But obviously, it didn't work. It seemed like things were moving in that direction in the second half of 1945, from Potsdam to London, and then on to Moscow in December. It seemed that things were moving in that direction, but it didn't work. So the question is, what went wrong? There must have been. See, it's a logical point. There must have been some exception to that general rule about how the two sides could get along with each other. What is that one exception? The answer there is the Soviets could not simply turn a blind eye and give the Western powers a totally free hand to do whatever they wanted in the western part of Germany, which in terms of its war-making potential, its industrial base, its technological level, was by far the most important part of Germany. The areas the Soviets controlled in the east were much more backward economically, much more agricultural. It's Western Germany, which is the heart of German power. Right? And the Soviets were bound to be concerned if the Western powers moved ahead in building up Germany, not just without them, which they could kind of accept, but against them. Right? If the West was being forced to give the Germans in the three Western zones more and more in the way of political rights, put them on their feet, first economically, maybe eventually help them build up their military power, restore a large measure of sovereignty to them, and feel that they had to do more and more and more and more to make sure that the Germans stayed within the Western camp, that they did not succumb to Soviet blandishments, that the way to achieve a reunified Germany was to move away from the Western camp, and acquire some sort of neutral status, or even worse. The West felt that it was under pressure, structural pressure, to move toward giving the Germans more and more in the way of political rights, ultimately military power. And if that happened, and especially if the West felt obliged, in order to keep Germany in their camp, to underwrite Germany's political aspirations, namely reunification, right, then there's no telling where this would lead. Right? Soviet control of the East might be threatened. Maybe not overnight, but if Germany became strong and independent, West Germany did, then how would that affect the behavior of the Germans in the Eastern zone, right? Wouldn't they be more inclined to rise up against their communist overlords, especially if West Germany might intervene in such a case? And especially if West Germany, supported by the Western powers, would be tempted to intervene? This is a cloud on the horizon. It's not something for tomorrow. But you can't just sit on your hands and allow the problem to fester and get worse and worse. You know, you want to take care of a problem sooner rather than later. You know, you want to nip things in the bud. So the West German, the whole question of giving the Western powers a totally free hand to do whatever they want to do in West Germany, that, you know, Soviets can't go along with that. And so they see the risk and they try and deal with it first in a soft way and then in a harder way. So soft way is sucking up to the Germans, you know, offering them more and more in the way of political rights. Right. This is Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov spoke in this sense in mid-1946, and Secretary of State Burns' Stuttgart speech that I told you about last time, September of 1946, holding up the prospect of kind of a Germany back on its feet with more and more control over its own destiny. This was a response. See, the Germans don't even have a state yet. And yet, East and West are kind of involved in kind of a bidding war for Germany's favor in 1946, right? So the Soviets try going the soft route, and it only leads the Americans to outbid them. And then, as we'll see in 1948, they go the hard route of responding to the Western policy of building up a West German state by blockading West Berlin, which is, just as Germany had been divided up into four zones, the Greater Berlin was divided up into four sectors. And the three Western sectors, British, French, and American sectors of West Berlin, this was like this tiny land island in the middle of communist East Germany. It's very easy for the Soviets to exercise pressure on the West by interfering with, cutting off Western contacts with West Berlin. But the more threatening the Soviets were, the more this would lead the Western powers to be concerned with building up their own strength, dealing with that threat, and a key element in building up the strength of the Western Bloc was building up West German power, putting West Germany back on her feet economically, ultimately militarily. This implied that Germany would have to be treated not as an occupied ex-enemy, but more as an ally. that you would have to kind of give the Germans more in terms of support for their basic political aspirations if you were going to get them to go along with the Western strategy. And this was particularly true since the Western strategy was based on the idea that Germany was going to be divided. If you're going to create a West German state aligned with the West, that's tantamount to foreclosing the option of German unification. Soviets will never simply hand over East Germany to become part of the Western Bloc, right? So there's this obvious concern that people in the West have that you move ahead with the Western strategy, a lot of German patriots, German nationalists, are not going to like it because it amounts to accepting a division of their own country. And so that means you have to up the ante yet further in terms of supporting their national goals. Right? So we respond by pursuing a policy that the Soviets are bound to view as threatening in the long run. That's not our intention. It's not our goal. But it's an inevitable consequence of what we're forced by the logic of the situation to do. We gotta kind of, you know, transform our relationship with the Germans, you know, go along with the policy, helping them, you know, get back their main political rights, put them back on their feet economically, ultimately help them build up their military power, integrate that military power in the Western Bloc. You know, all these things the Soviets are bound to view as threatening. But the more threatening they view them, the more of an incentive we have to move in that direction. You say, neither side wants war with the other. Neither side is deeply antagonistic to the other. But because of this German problem, the two sides are caught in this spiral. You know? Right. The more we move ahead with the Western strategy, the more the Soviets feel threatened, the more they engage in counter threats, the more we have to move ahead yet further, and so on and so on. And it's like, you see, this is a very different view of the whole story of the 1940s from this whole notion of, oh, it's just pure Soviet aggressiveness, Americans are all sweetness and light, the Soviets are this evil, aggressive power, and so on. What you're struck by is how not just the Soviets, but the Americans as well, are led by the logic of the situation to adopt policies that the other side would view as threatening, to adopt offensive policies for defensive purposes, right? And when I say that, that should trigger in your mind the connection with a certain political science concept, a concept which was developed in large part in this very building, right? With one of the two most important articles in international relations theory to be, you know, to come out since the end of World War II. This is Robert Jervis's Cooperation Under the Security Dilemma article. This is the Jervis Security Dilemma in action. They act aggressively for defensive purposes. They don't want conflict, but they're forced by the logic of the situation to do things that they know the other side is not going to like. They don't want to threaten the other side, but they have to do it in order to preserve their own interests, right? Very important on a theoretical level, and it's important because it helps us understand how you can have serious trouble even though neither side is fundamentally unhappy with the status quo. Right? The whole security dilemma theory is very closely connected with what Jervis called the spiral model of international conflict. You can see how things are spiraling up. You don't need an aggressor to have these kind of problems. It's built into the structure of things. It captures, that whole Jervis concept captures an awful lot of what was going on in the late 1940s. I think it's mistaken in three areas. One is that it doesn't take account of, as Jervis develops his argument, of the fact that this process was Germany-specific. It had everything to do with Germany. According to this theory, it's simply the bipolar structure of international politics, America and Russia. you know, at odds with each other, with each side led for defensive reasons to pursue policies they knew the other side wouldn't like. That's the heart of the problem. No, you have a purely bipolar system, you know, where there had been no German problem at all. Say the Germans had been, you know, wiped out during the war. Say we had built lots of atomic bombs well before the Normandy invasion and had simply dropped them on Germany, right? If there had been no Germany, you wouldn't have had the security alignment, right? It's Germany specific. That's number one. It's not automatic. It's not built into the basic structure of the system. And not just that, but it takes an awful lot to get the wheels turning, to get this process, the spiral process, moving. A lot, especially in terms of Soviet aggressiveness, not in Europe, but in the Near East in early 1946. The Turkish and Iranian crises of the spring of 1946. You know, that's what transforms the whole American concept. It says, we can't just count on on the Soviets accepting the division of Europe out of the goodness of their hearts. There's one thing that keeps the Soviets at bay, and that's power. You know, we got to build up the power of the West. We got to incorporate West German power into the overall power of the Western camp. And that's what led to the transformation of American policy on the German question that we saw, and that's what got this whole thing turning. All right, so that was the story last time of the 1946-47 period, and you know, it's very, you know, the story is very interesting. You can see how Burns has pushed along in 1946 in this direction, along the lines of the Western strategy, right? We saw the reparation stop in April, and then the decision to create the buy zone in July, and then the Stuttgart speech in September of 46, right? We're clearly moving in that direction. And the Soviets are not happy with this. And then January of 47, Burns is basically dismissed from office and is replaced by General Marshall. And Marshall takes a very different line. He doesn't like this stuff. He is not comfortable with the Western strategy because he thinks it's poisoning our relations with the Soviets. And in the long run, we got to get along with these people. The American people, they might be a little upset right now, might be in a kind of militant mood right now, but that you can't sustain that forever. This is very, very typical of Marshall's thinking. Even during the war, he was very concerned with the willingness of the American people to stick to it make the kind of sacrifices that were needed, right? And he tries very hard to see whether something can be worked out with the Soviets, some sort of, you know, a four-power regime, cooperative regime with them for Germany. And as I said, he spends like the better part of 2 months in the spring of 1947 over in Russia trying to work this stuff out with Stalin. You know, just a big failure. You know, and so finally it comes back, you know, we have the Marshall Plan. The whole idea of the Marshall Plan is to put all of Western Europe back on its feet economically, but ultimately with the goal of creating a strong West European bloc that could balance Soviet power in Europe. And the Soviets react in kind. They unleash the French and Italian communist parties. France especially is in a pre-revolutionary situation there in 1947. It doesn't quite come to civil war. It's quite serious. And then the Soviets are now, you know, much more militant in terms of their propaganda. This is the period, the Soviet foreign policy, they call the Zhdanovshchina. Zhdanov was one of Stalin's henchmen who gave this, you know, very militant portrayal of the emerging international conflict. Okay. And it's increasingly clear that Marshall's hope that you could work things out with the Soviets, it's just not going to work. And everything kind of comes to a head at the London Conference in December of 1947. the conference of no return, as Cyril Buffet puts it. London Foreign Ministers Conference at the end of the year, you know, just two sides, you know, slinging one at each other. Marshall just in frustration, without even consulting with the British and the French, he just says, I've had enough. This is not going to work. And basically the failure of the attempt to deal with the German issue on a four-power basis leads the three Western powers to decide at London that they're going to start this whole process that's going to lead to the building of a West German state, that they're going to organize their zones of Germany by themselves and not caring at all what the Russian reactions be. Now, you know, what's a real interest here is you look at Marshall. He didn't want this. His hope was to salvage some shreds of four-power cooperation. He did not want this conflict with the Russians. And yet the structure of the situation, the logic of the situation, it was just so powerful that Marshall didn't have any chance to kind of successfully pursue a radically different policy. And even he, you know, in the final analysis, is led to say, we have no alternative but to move ahead with a Western strategy, to move ahead with building up this West German state. Okay? And so the events of the year 1948 and going into 1949 proceed along three closely interconnected paths. First, the process leading to the creation of a West German state, which is proclaimed in April of 1949. The process officially began with the adoption of what were called the London Recommendations in June of 1948. The Germans were basically going to design their own state, but under the close supervision of the three Western occupying authorities. And this would not be an independent state, by the way. The occupation regime would still be maintained intact. There would be something called an occupation statute, which would determine what the rights and powers of the three occupying powers were, as opposed to the powers of the Federal Republic, not a sovereign state, all right? The Soviet reaction to this process leading to the creation of a West German state, which is the Berlin blockade, is an obvious lever. The city of Berlin, right after the London recommendations are issued, city of Berlin is blockaded. And the blockade lasts also into the spring of 1949. And then the fact that the Soviets are interfering with our access to Berlin, right, which we had a right to. That created a certain sense that this whole business might escalate to the level of a Third World War. And certainly, the West Europeans, if they were kind of go along with America and side with America in this developing conflict with Russia and run these risks of war, they were going to have something in the way of real security guarantees. And so our reaction to the Berlin blockade is the creation of the North Atlantic Treaty, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the NATO Treaty, also of April 1949. I mean, just look at the timing here, and you have to say these things are all closely interconnected. You know, you can't treat these things in isolation from each other. What's of interest about the Berlin blockade? Is this like a Soviet, an attempt on the part of the Soviets to just grab another little piece of land? Not at all. But again, when you think of these things in power political terms, you can see that just can't be. It's like our presence in West Berlin, this is our Achilles heel. It's so easy for them to put pressure on us there. This is a weak point in our position. It's a source of vulnerability for us. Right, so you think the last thing that they would want to do is to lose that source of leverage, They wouldn't want us to leave West Berlin. They would want us to care about staying there, because this is a way of putting pressure on us. Very effective. I should say, well, you know, some American leaders, like President Kennedy, understood this. It's like one of the things that Kennedy was quite pleased about with the establishment of the communist regime in Cuba was that it basically neutralized our vulnerability in Berlin. The Soviet commitment to Castro's Cuba, you know, this was a countervailing source of leverage for us. You know, they got out of hand in Berlin. We could react by putting pressure on them in Cuba. That's just an aside. This Berlin blockade, the other thing about it, they're not interested in taking over the city of Berlin. They make this clear. They make it clear that their whole goal is political. You know, Stalin actually tells the American ambassador, Beale Smith, he says, well, after all, we're still allies. We're not willing to go to war for the sake of Berlin, not really. Truman says, we don't have enough troops for this. You know, it's like they cut off land access, so we're forced to resort to the airlift to kind of provision the population in West Berlin, famous Berlin airlift. Truman says, well, what if they put up barrage balloons and try and prevent the airlift from being effective? We can't even shoot down those barrage balloons. Right? So we're not willing to, really, you know, because we had torn up our military machine, our ability to, mount a serious military effort, at least in the short run, is fairly limited. And as for the Soviets, they're not interested really in defeating the airlift. And it would have been the easiest thing in the world for them to do so, by the way. I don't know if any of you have ever been to that part of the world in the wintertime. In wintertime, it's overcast every single day. You know why? Because the whole cold continental air mass from, you know, Siberia and Central Asia is colliding with the warm, moist air from the Gulf Stream in the Atlantic, right off of Western Europe. And so it's always cloudy. And in the wintertime, this is. And the only way that these planes can make it into the airport in West Berlin is through radar, right, to go through the cloud cover. It's the easiest thing in the world if you want to frustrate that by jamming the radar. It's not even a violent measure. You're not even shooting down the planes. You're just jamming the radar. Not only did the Soviets not jam the radar, but Soviet officers cooperate with their Western counterparts in the Berlin Air Traffic Center to guide the planes into Berlin. I mean, when you get into this issue at that level of detail, you can see that these notions, oh, the Soviets are so aggressive, they just want to take over Berlin and so on, it doesn't capture the reality. This is a political move. The Soviet goal, and they pretty much say this as openly as could be, is saying, we don't like the fact what you're doing in West Germany. We're worried about it. We want to talk. Right? It's a political move designed to put pressure on the West so as to get the West to take their political concerns seriously. Right? The italics, the exclamation point. In the Soviet insistence that they have a right to some say over what the Western powers are doing in West Germany. Right? Okay. So what can we give them? Again, it's this basic question. What can you give them? What sort of cooperation? What are you going to do? You're going to say, oh, yeah, come in and help run West Germany with us? Of course, we accept the fact that you're not going to allow us to run East Germany with you. You know, it's like, what are the Americans going to say? No, we understand your concerns about Germany. We're not going to let Germany get too strong, you know, because the Americans, if the word of that gets out and and the Germans get the sense that we're colluding with the Soviets to keep Germany down, what's that going to do to the Western strategy? You see,
destroys the PR image.
Yeah, I mean, you can see how difficult these issues are, and that no one on any of these sides is being aggressive, But it's this kind of core structural problem that they're forced to confront. All right. So what happens? Well, this whole process runs its course and culminates in the spring of 1949. As I say, the West German state is established. Not a truly independent state. It's still subject to the occupation statute. And in fact, you know, Germany's political rights were limited not just through the end of the Cold War, but even the treaty that established the framework for the unification of Germany limited Germany's political rights in important ways. Germany is not allowed, according to the terms of that treaty, to develop nuclear forces under its own control. Right? I mean, that's important because a non-nuclear power cannot on its own stand up to a great nuclear power like the Soviet Union or Russia even, that would be threatening them. Right? The effect there is to limit German independence in important ways, German power in important ways. So you have this West German state, still under occupation, but tied into the Western system. There's a terrific book by a German scholar who deals with this period of, and it's called the Occupied Ally, right? Because Germany's still under occupation. Germany is, in effect, an ally of the West. It's kind of ambiguity in Germany's status. I should say, with regard to this point, it shows you that the Western powers, they're sensitive to these Soviet concerns, which they, and especially the British and the French, share to a certain degree. We don't trust the Germans. We can't say this too loud, though. We don't want them to become too strong. We don't want them to become too independent. But we can't, you know, treat them as a colony, so we're going to have to play this game, but we don't want to do it too overtly. You know, it's and the question is, with all of those ambiguities, how much stability is there in a system of that sort, where things aren't just clear and, you know, overt?
Was there a communist party in Germany, Western Germany?
There was a communist party in Germany. It had been important before the Nazis. In the post-war period, it was of trivial importance. There are very few members of the German Communist Party in West Germany. And then, in fact, a little later on, it was outlawed. It was illegal to be, for the Communist Party to exist in Western Germany. In the East, of course, there was a communist-type party called the Socialist Unity Party. There was this forced merger between the communists and the social democrats there. Okay. German state is created. The Soviets seem to accept this. What's the evidence of that? They end the Berlin blockade in May of 1949. And the previous month, the West, the reasons I discussed, had signed the North Atlantic Treaty, creating NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Okay? Seems, I should say, this whole NATO business, is this the case of America, this great imperial power, you know, throwing its weight around, you know, insisting on, playing the leading role in Western Europe, and Western Europe is like part of this American empire? you hear those kinds of arguments from time to time, especially from Europeans. Americans don't want this. We don't want to be stuck in Europe forever. We want the Europeans to provide for their own defense. We think that ultimately they'll be capable of doing that. For the time being, they're going to need this American umbrella while they're building themselves up, you know, getting back on their own feet economically and so on. But ultimately, we want the Europeans to provide for their own defense. And it's the Europeans who don't like that. They don't like that whole notion, right? Because imagine a Western Europe without the American presence. How's it going to develop enough power to stand up to the Soviets? Well, only by allowing the Germans to develop as much power as they can. And if Germany becomes that strong, how are the other Europeans going to keep them in line? how the other Europeans are going to keep the Germans from pursuing a policy aimed at the unification of their own country, getting the Soviets out of East Germany. And then a lot of Germans, they understand that anything that looks like a buildup of German power would be provocative for the Soviets. They want that American protection. They understand that the other Europeans are concerned about Germany becoming too strong, or at least a lot of people in Germany feel this way, Western Germany, Rhineland especially. The British are dead set against all these notions of an independent Europe. The British, more than anyone else, like the whole idea of an Atlantic community, not of a freestanding Europe. Right? So the Europeans want the Americans to stay. The Americans are leery about all this stuff. The Europeans keep pulling us in. Okay? Again, it shows you how structural considerations shape the course of events, not political intent to anything like the degree that we think. All right. So you look at these three components of the system that had come into being by the spring of 1949. The creation of the Federal Republic of Germany, West German state. The end of the Berlin blockade, signifying Soviet acceptance of a West German state. North Atlantic Treaty, American involvement in Europe. Okay? So doesn't this system provide us with a chance for peace? Second chance for peace. First chance for peace, Potsdam, right? Let's divide Europe. You control the East, we'll control the West. Well, why didn't that work? That was the focus of the analysis in the last few lectures. Now there's a second chance for peace, formal division of Europe into the blocs. So Soviets respond to the creation of West Germany by setting up their own little puppet state in East Germany. So-called German Democratic Republic, it was called. Right? Eventually, they set up a counterpart to NATO called the Warsaw Pact. Right? A formal division of Europe. You say, well, shouldn't that have worked? The Soviets had done what they could to prevent this. Now they're accepting it. See? But we know, once again, we know it doesn't work. You know, it's just like we looked at 45. We know it didn't work because of what happened in 1946. Two sides are screaming at each other. We know that 1949 doesn't work because of what happens in 1950-51. It's a terrible winter of 1950-51 when it seems that the world is on the verge of a third great war. And so, again, this brings the problem into focus for us. What went wrong? Why didn't these 1949 arrangements provide the basis for a stable international order? Okay? Basically, you're like one minute to go. I'll tell you what the answer is very briefly now, and then I'll begin with this next Wednesday. The answer has to do with the one of the greatest events in the history of the entire Cold War period, which happened on August 29, 1949. The breaking of the American nuclear monopoly. The first Soviet explosion of an atomic bomb. And this changed everything. Changed everything for reasons that I will explain to you when we reconvene after the President's Day holiday. Okay, so but the key thing to bear in mind is second great chance for peace. Why doesn't it work?